You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 233.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. Today, finally joined by Aaron again after so much traveling around the country, around the world from both of us. It's good to be back. And man, I am behind on these episodes. I am so sorry. So thanks.
It's good to be back in the saddle. Let's see if we can catch up.
Yeah, thanks for bailing me out today. And I do have some extra. I am working on some guests, but you know, While I was away, I was networking with people who might be guests, so that's good. But you know, it takes a little while for it to all come through. But in the meantime, I think people are enjoying just listening to me and just listening to me and you, because the numbers have been going up a little bit. Haven't reached our all-time high, but I see more listeners. So that's
been
pretty cool.
Can't argue with the data.
Yeah. All right. So today we're just going to talk about all the craziness in the crypto markets. So what happened was, for the first time in years, I left for a two-week trip. And that's when everything just starts to explode right on the first day one. That of course has to happen, right? So that's just that's the thing. It probably sometimes saves me from myself, but it is kind of a tradition. And of course, what's happened in the crypto industry and in Bitcoin, we see a price drop, a rather large price drop from the standards of any given asset, although from crypto standards, it's a large drop, but kind of something we've seen before. But also we've seen this comes amidst a lot of other trouble in the industry. So
it's tough to judge how it's moving on multiple fronts, because, okay, so what do you benchmark it against? If there's all this talk about inflation and the dollar and other currencies moving around, and so can you consider that a reliable benchmark to measure crypto off of? But then there's also talk of, well, in theory at least, a lot of people were saying, well, when inflation spikes and the dollar becomes less desirable, then crypto is gonna skyrocket, and that is not what we've seen in the last month or so.
Right.
So what's really going on?
So I talked about inflation last time, and as I pointed out, we have high inflation but not hyperinflation, which means even at 8-10% inflation, like that's a lot. It drains your money over the course of a few years, but when you're benchmarking things off of weeks, as we're doing here with cryptocurrency, then then just the price is a pretty good benchmark, I would say. Now, some people think it's the raising of interest rates that's causing this as well, that the federal reaction to try to fight the inflation. I think there's a connection, but I think it's a little overblown, as we'll see in a little bit. Just one great source for all of this is Naomi Brockwell, who's been on the show for a few times, and she has a thing on Substack of crypto contagion spreads. So if you want to read more about it, I think that's a great article to read just right off the bat. But I think now we're going to try to hit on all the high points of what's happened and try to at least have some level of understanding and then kind of some level of where to go from here. So first of all,
before you jump into that, let me throw out one thing. And you mentioned we're not experiencing hyperinflation. And I think in your last episode, you mentioned your Zimbabwean dollars or
what? Yeah. Oh, I should get it out.
Dollar bills, billion dollar bills.
But then I have to leave the room.
So
$100 million. I could have gotten $100 trillion, but that would cost me like $300. And I was like, nah, I think I could make my point with a $100 million bill.
I did see something earlier this week that apparently Zimbabwe's inflation rate as of June 25th hit 191.6% actual. So it sounds like
still.
This was from
10 years
coming
ago.
Coming into their second round of massive inflation in a generation.
Yeah. Wow. I had a professor once who, when he said, we always call large numbers astronomical because astronomy has big numbers, but they really should be called economical numbers, which, you know, is some sort of analogy to the economy, maybe, because economical sounds small. But yeah. So anyway, before we go on to what's happening in 2022, I want to read the 2018 Beyond the Bubble, What Happened to Bitcoin in 2018. This is very similar to the 2018 crash, at least in terms of price. 2018 crash was far worse in terms of price. And two paragraphs from this article, which is from Fast Company from 2018, kind of hit home today. One is towards the beginning of the article. It says, when Bitcoin was rising last year, it seemed like a trend everybody from your grandmother to your barista was suddenly becoming hip to. Of course, plenty of folks cautioned that it could be a bubble, but it's always hard to realize such a thing when you're in the midst of it. It's free money, right? Why not get in on it? Just don't remortgage your house. And there's a link on that. I assume someone remortgaged their house and got into trouble. And then the last, the link could just be, that's just my assumption. Maybe they're fooling us. Anyway, the last paragraph is, they tried to add a final paragraph of hope from 2018. And so they wrote from a critic who had, quote unquote, called the bubble all along. Those are the people who always come out. And he said, this is a legitimate technology. It's going to expand. My longer term view is nowhere near some of my current views are. It could perhaps hit 10,000 again, he said, but that will probably take a few years. For now, wait and see. Now, as you know, Bitcoin at that point plunged, and this is only a few years ago, plunged down to $3,000. It felt like it was just going to stay there and it was just dead. And it ended up hitting 10,000 again. This was November 2018, I think, by the following summer or following spring. So six months. So, yeah.
Less than a year later. And so this was approximately 4 years ago. And what again is the duration of the halvening?
That's 4 years. Yeah,
it is 4 years.
So
okay.
We'll talk about that. There does seem to be a pattern there, and I think that makes sense. I know some people don't agree, but this is part of my take on it. Now, of course, just because there's some predictable cycle with the halvening, each one is a little bit different, and each one has different players causing different types of errors, different scales of errors. And so let's go through those first, then we could talk about the halvening, right? And what that means.
Even if there is a detectable signal in the cycle, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the dominant signal.
Right. And also each halvening, which means that the amount of Bitcoin being created, so to speak, gets less and less. It gets cut in half essentially every 4 years. Eventually, I would think that becomes a non-issue because
you would expect the effects to eventually taper.
Right,
it's
right.
Becoming less and less significant.
Okay,
or
so
dramatic, I guess.
Maybe this happens again a few more cycles, but we don't know. Anyway, so what were the actual problems? So some of them, and by the way, some of them I went more technically in depth in on other ones. This is the one I know less about, but the one that kicked it off is this UST thing that blew up Uniswap. UST was a stable coin. A stable coin is a cryptocurrency that is pegged to another asset, like in this case, the dollar. And the idea is, you know, I have a bunch of dollars in reserve and I issue this cryptocurrency. It's somewhat centralized, but you can, like, you know, kind of just trade it as kind of, you know, by forwarding on cryptographic signatures. So they're still mining. They're still a blockchain. Basically, I back it and I'm willing to trade you dollars for it. So it's pegged to the dollar.
So I've heard some conflicting things about stablecoins because one thing I've heard is that it's not intended to be, you know, really held or invested in, that it's a method for basically getting money in and out of crypto, that rather than having to go directly from US dollars to Bitcoin or vice versa, you can take other crypto holdings, convert them into a stablecoin, and then converting the stablecoin into US dollars is much simpler.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's the point.
But on the other hand, I have a very small amount invested in actually not well, I have a small amount with BlockFi, which
we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah,
so do I.
Which I put there as quote unquote dollars, but I believe it's actually denominated in a stable coin equivalent to U.S. dollars. It's not that they're actually holding it in dollars. I think it's like
USDC. I bet.
Yeah, USD yeah. something like Gemini or one of those.
Yeah. So USDC is the main one, and I would say that's probably the most reliable one. There's also Tether that's used internationally. That gets more criticism. I'm just not exactly sure why. But this one, UST was obviously really messed up because they were doing all sorts of complicated stuff that led to them essentially losing the peg. They couldn't back it from the dollar, lost its value, and then, you know, A lot of companies.
I heard something about how it was a quote unquote algorithmic stable coin, which I don't know much about exactly how that was implemented, but it sounds like a fancy term for there was a lot of hand waving in the background. They didn't actually have sufficient backing. And that's why it got out of whack.
That's a good way to look at it, because I feel a little you know, I feel like part of the reason for the local maximum is for us to explain what's going on. So if something called an algorithmic coin, I want to be able to explain to the audience what the algorithm is. But it seems to be very opaque. I just don't get it. I don't want to look into it. And that probably is for a reason. It's probably there, you know, that sometimes things are opaque to hide the fact that it doesn't really add, things don't really add up.
Well, and that's a big piece of the crypto kind of value proposition, is that the algorithm is maybe the wrong term for it, but the whole like blockchain, it's essentially open source. Like there's no secret sauce into how it's being done. You can look at all the code for how it works and understand it. And as with all open source projects, hopefully that means that many eyes you know, make few bugs.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's why people criticize some of these other projects, and, you know, rightfully so. So another one of the dominoes to fall is Celsius. So Celsius is one of these companies where you can give them your cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or USDC or whatever, and earn a return on it. And it's very scary for Celsius holders right now, because they have, they've halted trading. Essentially, whatever you have on there, that's it. It's stuck and you can't get it out. Now, how did we get into this situation, first of all? So there's something, there's several dominoes that you have to understand before you get to this. So Ethereum
just to be clear, yeah. Celsius is itself a coin.
No, but it's a company. It's like BlockFi. Okay. It's like, yeah.
So Celsius is like
they have a coin,
a broker, but, or a company. Okay.
Yeah. It's you could think of it as kind of like a savings and loan type company. Like you put gotcha. Your money in and they lend it out and they get a return on it. Fair enough. So back up a little bit from this a second. So we have Ethereum, that is the second largest cryptocurrency. It specializes in smart contracts, you know, the ability to create tokens on it, to trade tokens based on logic.
And is Celsius specifically focused on Ethereum, or that's just a part of their portfolio of?
Well, it's a part, but there's I'll get into what the problem is here. So first of all, Ethereum is working on essentially upgrading itself, making changes to the blockchain rules. Now, I don't know exactly how you do that, but apparently they're moving from proof of work to proof of stake. Now, that could be a whole episode on proof of work versus proof of stake. Proof of work is what makes Bitcoin works. It's what gives its monetary properties. In other words, if you want to create more Bitcoin, if you want to be a miner and get more Bitcoin, you have to expend energy to do that. And proof of stake is like based on, you know, the current owners are the ones who have like a stake in the system, who kind of call the shots. So
now,
essentially
is this
what they're doing,
of the ETH versus ETH2, or is that
yes.
a completely separate? Oh, that,
this
so
is
that's
what it
the
is.
Distinction we're talking.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I think what they're doing is they're sacrificing some of the monetary properties of Bitcoin and some decentralization, But not all decentralization will still be a blockchain. It'll still be, but they're trading some of that for efficiency in executing smart contracts, which is what Ethereum is good at. So this is a move that might be true that it makes sense for Ethereum and not Bitcoin, which is why they're doing it. But we'll see. So okay, anyway, it requires people to stake their Ethereum in order to get the system to work. In order to get rewards. So apparently people stake their Ethereum. Somehow it's used to validate the transactions. I'm not exactly sure how. And then after a time, that Ethereum gets unstaked and they get a little reward from that, which is like the gas fees from all of the smart contracts.
So how is this different from in a traditional dollars economy, from me putting money in the bank and getting interest on my savings account?
This is all occurring on the blockchain. So it's going to be like internal to how the blockchain works, and they're not going to be creating new Ethereum. Basically, this is all going to be running through the fees of the smart contracts are going to go into paying the people who are staking their Ethereum. To run a smart contract on Ethereum, it requires it requires a little bit. Each smart contract has to have a little Ethereum in there that then gets spent as the thing is run.
So this staking is completely distinct from mining.
Well, yeah, it's sort of a alternative now. So that's the idea. I don't want to necessarily get into all the details, but
in a proof of stake system, is there no mining anymore? Is that happening in parallel?
I'm not entirely sure. I believe not. I believe it's all. I mean, you still have to have validators running the smart contracts, right? And so I guess the staking is the mining. And so I'm sorry, you've reached the limits of my understanding.
Well, because I guess the thing that I'm a little unclear on is mining is a way to introduce additional coins into circulation. And if that's not happening, if it's all proof of stake and gas fees, then it sounds like the market is the total, number of ETH would then be capped.
Exactly.
Unless there's some other mechanism that's introducing them.
You're exactly right. And there are people who are saying, oh man, we're going to make so much money when this thing comes out because it's going to be hard capped. There remain to be seen, that kind of works for Bitcoin. We're not sure if that works for Ethereum yet.
Gotcha.
So there's a little bit of a halving there. And I feel like I've seen comments online where this is like five halvings. But then that kind of suggests that there's still something coming, some new Ethereum coming into the system. So it's kind of unclear what's going on. I don't have the exact numbers, but apparently new issuance of Ethereum is going to drop precipitously when this comes out. Now, they've been testing this for a long time, years, in fact. They said they're going to come out with it this year. There are a few delays. It's a software project. It's a very important software project. So much money is on the line. So they keep testing it. They keep delaying it. Now, there's some Ethereum that is already staked as they build this, and you could stake Ethereum as they build this, and you're getting rewards as it goes. But that Ethereum stays on chain; you can't withdraw it until they finish this upgrade. So it's
locked in until release day.
Right. Now you can trade staked Ethereum. I could be like, hey, I have 10 Ethereum that I have staked. I can't get it out, but I'll sell it. I'll sell you a claim on that, and so you'll get it when it does come out. And so companies are doing that, but because of the kind of uncertainty, so that used to trade very closely to Ethereum, like claims of staked Ethereum. But because of the uncertainty, the trades are no longer one-to-one. And I think my understanding is that Celsius assumes that it would be one-to-one, and then it became illiquid as a result. They're waiting for their Ethereum to thaw, their ETH to thaw, and it ain't thawing. So my thought on that is they must have done quite a bit more wrong to not be able to get a loan or something to cover them until this thing is done. But they must have done this and a whole bunch of other things to really mess up. So yeah, that ended up halting trading a couple weeks ago. The speculation that they're just illiquid, but they have all of this staked Ethereum that they can't get out of there, and so they can't let anyone take their money out. But everyone who has their money on the platform can access it, and it's uncertain if they ever will. Though I think it's if this is the main problem, it's likely something will be worked out in the long run. But this kind of even if it's just Celsius, it kind of makes everybody less trustworthy, if you know what I mean. Like, it's just sure. Like, well, if this one didn't work, maybe...
Is there realistically a concern that like, if Celsius goes under, then all those ETH are locked up and can't be accessed by anyone, and they basically become orphaned? Or is it the type of thing where...
No.
Yeah, maybe they can go under because they can't be liquid enough to operate, but everyone keeps their assets the trade in frozen ETH will probably drop even more if that happens, but it doesn't evaporate or get, you know, locked and the keys lost.
Yeah. So if the company goes under, they'll get liquidated. That has not happened yet, by the way. So they're still main to be seen. 3 Hours Capital, which we'll get to in a second, is getting liquidated as we speak. But Celsius is not. As we speak, again, this could change. But the first people to suffer when a company list like this gets liquidated are the shareholders. They're the owners. So it could just pass on to new ownership. And then now, the new ownership then can start on a more solid basis because it basically goes to the creditors. And so hopefully it doesn't affect the depositors, but you never know. So it depends how big of a hole they're in,
right?
Essentially.
And unlike if your savings and loan goes under, there's no FDIC and insurance on this. That it's completely up to however the company goes under and who buys it up and how they handle that.
Yeah, I should point out nowadays some of these companies, I don't know about Celsius, do have FDIC insurance. So, but.
Well, right. I know that was a big thing with BlockFi, is that they basically had to transition to operating more like a traditional bank in some ways.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. All right. So 3 Arrows Capital. So that's what's going on with Celsius. That's the high level thing. 3 Arrows Capital. That's the company out of Singapore, which apparently.
When you first said their name, I thought it was 3 Hours Capital. I said, that doesn't. That doesn't give me a feeling of confidence and longevity.
Three arrows.
It's arrows like bows and arrow.
Yeah, yeah. So they apparently, I don't know what they were doing, but they are apparently being liquidated. And apparently all of these companies, like everyone, loaned to them. And 3 Arrows Capital just went bust and can't pay back the loan anymore. Now, a lot of these companies have... collateral on 3 Arrows Capital, where either they got collateral directly or they have a claim on the company's liquidated assets. And so that includes BlockFi and Voyager and Celsius. They all lent to 3 Arrows Capital. So there is some collateral. And then when 3 Arrows Capital is liquidated, their assets will help make the creditors whole. But there will still be losses, and they'll have to wait for this process to finish. So this whole everyone lending to this one big company that had an overly optimistic view of what crypto was going to do in the short term seems like a really big mistake, a really bad cluster of errors that has certainly happened. There's historical precedent for that. It seems like a huge blind spot to me. Yeah, there'll be losses. Can it be contained at that? We'll have to see. We'll have to wait for this process to finish. So, the reports are that BlockFi and Voyager have gotten lines of credit from this company, step in, stage right, FTX. So that is a company, one of the crypto whale companies, brand new, founded in 2019 by 30-year-old billionaire and MIT grad Sam Bankman-Fried. So probably a friend of yours from when you were in college. No, he was too young.
He's in the Bahamas. I see where his name is familiar from. I've heard about him from the effective altruism world, because I guess he's either donated or pledged a large portion of his fortune.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. So, essentially he's given lifelines to BlockFi and Voyager, not out of the goodness of his heart. This is not part of, this is not part of the effect of altruism. I'm sure he's taken a cut of the companies. And there's even a report that today on CNBC, it said BlockFi is going on fire sale to FTX, which means that essentially the investors would all get wiped out. But for people who have money in BlockFi, that's great because now you're backed by one of the big guys. So the CEO of BlockFi, Zach Prince, he denied this and said, no, this is not happening. So no one else has yet to confirm or deny. So we're still unsure of what's going on. And we still don't know a lot about what the balance sheet of this these companies really look like. It does appear that they had losses. It appears that it's not deep enough for them to go completely bust and under, but it might be deep enough for like a fire sale. So we'll see what happens. I found this.
So you said we kind of have to wait and see how this shakes out. How long do you expect it's going to take to kind of get a resolution? Are we looking at, you know, days, weeks, months, years?
That's a good question.
This is all,
I don't know.
Settled.
I don't think it's going to take years to know how these companies will shake out. Probably, my guess, a few months. But then, like, you know, look, especially the Celsius thing, or especially the 3AC thing, when you have a big company like that getting liquidated, there are always residual lawsuits and stuff going on years and stuff.
Won't be concluded that quickly, but
yeah.
We should at least have a much clearer picture of where
it's
going.
Yeah.
And what the end game looks like.
Yeah. But my guess is, I mean, look, if the CEO is vehemently denying this fire sale, maybe that report was exaggerated. It could just be that FTX is taking a large cut of some of these companies and the investors are getting, it's called inflated. I think it's called inflated quite a bit. Is it inflated or no, diluted? Diluted. It's different from inflated.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we just take a moment to recognize the what's the term? Is it nominative determinism of Samuel Bankman Fried coming in and bailing these guys out?
You know, I didn't notice that. So he's the bank man that's going to Fried you. Okay, yeah, I get it. I don't know.
Makes you wonder if we're living in the simulation or not.
It kind of does. It kind of does. I did not notice that. That is a great observation. Okay, so in response to this, I found this tweet interesting from Ter de Meester on Twitter. He's been in the Bitcoin space for about 10 years, so this guy's been tweeting on this for a long time. He writes, less than a year ago, BlockFi raised a $500 million round. This is what can happen with fractional reserve banking, improperly secured loans, and maturity mismatching. Bitcoin is going through puberty. Now, he walked this back a little when he realized that the fire sale is still in doubt, but I suspect that the same sentiment still holds. And now, of course, there are a lot of people saying, like, you know, you should only keep your money. You should hold it yourself. You shouldn't let anyone hold it because then they'll rehypothecate it and this stuff could happen and it could be stressful. I have to say, like, you know, for me, I want to make a return on some of my crypto. So I do lend it out to some of these companies. But I also have a large chunk of it that I store myself. And I have to say that chunk is giving me a lot less headaches these days. So I don't know. Maybe there's something to be said for that. All right. So
how panicked should I be, given that I have a small but non-zero amount with in this case with BlockFi, for example?
So BlockFi, I mean, you could just withdraw it from BlockFi. You're not really getting any return on that, right? I would just say, I mean, if I had to put a probability on like having problems withdrawing that, I'd say it's pretty low, but I wouldn't, you know, I'd personally feel more comfortable taking it out and putting it somewhere else, whether it's on my own wallet or even a company like Coinbase, where, you know, it's still, they say, you know, not your keys, not your coin, but Coinbase is not doing the whole rate of return thing. And so they're, I think they're on like a sounder basis than BlockFi is. So I wouldn't panic, first of all. Like panic is never good, but like there's nothing there's nothing here that would warrant a serious panic. That's my take on it. I'd say I'm a lot less bullish on putting stuff in there than I was, for sure.
I haven't brought notes to back this up, but I believe I heard something in the last couple of weeks about I think it was Coinbase laying off a portion of their staff because I may be extrapolating too much, but the narrative that I was fed on this was that they kind of overextended, and it looks like we're going to be in a little bit of a crypto downturn for a while, so they needed to slim down.
Yeah, and I mean it's amazing because these downturns happen so regularly that it's like, why wouldn't you prepare for that? I probably would have overestimated what the downturn would have been. I probably thought the bottom would have been, I probably would have thought 2 years ago we'd have a higher top and a higher bottom, but still, like, you know, you have to leave this open as a possibility. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. We still have to follow up on their whole like no politics at work thing that we talked about a couple years ago, which doesn't seem to be, isn't being blamed for this. It seems like if it was being blamed for this, then we would have known about it. But anyway, it'll take years to sort out how that's done. All right. So, I hope I answered your question on BlockFi to the best of my ability. What does the future look like? Well, we've been here before on price movements, and the two examples I could give are January of 2015, where there was a price plunge down to $180 a Bitcoin, and in November 2018, when there was a plunge down to $3,500. And both of those were about a year and a half before the next halving, and I do think there's a natural part of the cycle. Now, by the way, There was another crash that people point to as similar. I don't think it's similar, and that's the COVID crash. That was in March of 2020, and Bitcoin dropped to 4,000, and then it quickly recovered. And I think it's not that bad things don't happen at all parts of the cycle.
What was the peak it was dropping from at that point? Just to calibrate.
15,000.
Okay, so that was and
it was 20,000 in 2017. So it was 20,000.
It was losing like two-thirds of its value rapidly.
Yeah. So
in this case, we've dropped what, about half?
Well, it depends on where you start counting. Right. But yeah, I mean, if you count from the top, it's almost it's almost like 70%. I think that I think that one recovered fast, not just because of macro things, but I also think that it's because we were too close to the next halving at that point. And so, if this happens, I do think that the crashes have kind of different cycles. So the bad stuff that happens mid-halving is going to keep the value low for a time, a significant time, which is unlike the COVID crash, which it came back very quickly. Now, the one in 2018, that also came back pretty quickly. Like I said, you know, it said, oh, maybe it'll get back to 10,000. You did have to wait a good 5 months for that to occur. January 2015, you didn't have a big uptick until October of that year. So you had to wait almost a full year or 9 months. So that's kind of my benchmark on what I think is going to happen. So I do think there's a cycle, but be careful about trying to predict what the cycle is. There was famously Plan B's stock to flow model, which I liked. I thought it was doing a good job, but that overestimated where things were going. And then there was this crazy theory going around called the super cycle that was like, no, we're going to like a million next year, because even the past cycles are not are not good enough. We're in a super cycle now. And so apparently the super cycle was Three Arrows Capital's working thesis. It didn't work out too well for them. So yeah, I think what's going to happen is bad actors who over leverage will be taken out. It's going to be an uncertain time for investors in these companies. And even for depositors, we're going to sweat a little bit. If I have to make a prediction, why don't I make a prediction? And we'll hold me to it. It's not like people on TV who just move on. I predict that the price will be back up, not at an all-time high, but kind of like an uptick from now in a year at most, and could be sooner. I'm using the 2015 and 2018 as a benchmark. Essentially, the next halving occurs early 2024. So it's a little less than 4 years, actually. And I think that's true even if the Fed keeps hiking rates. People say, okay, you know, if this is because the Federal Reserve is hiking rates and that's making the stock market go down and that's making Bitcoin go down. And that is true to an extent. And that's one of the things causing all of these things to come to a head right now. But in Bitcoin, you also have this thing where it's a growing ecosystem of a new technology. So it's not so, yes, like the internet can fall in like the internet bubble of 2000 or 99 to 2001, but that's not like going to keep the internet down permanently. And well, you did have interest rates lowering there, but if they just kept interest rates high throughout that whole thing, I mean, maybe we'd be in economic trouble, but you'd still have the internet growing, and you wouldn't be able to keep the Amazon down for long in the early 2000s. I think we can now say that. So I think the overwhelming effects over the medium term is going to be the fact that it's a growing ecosystem and network. So that's my thesis on this. Hope it makes sense. Any questions before we announce my new segment? Oh, look, I see you posted the chart there. Maybe I'll post that online.
Yeah, I was just looking at the Bitcoin price history. It shows the key highs and lows. I have to keep reminding myself that it's the y-axis is in log scale. Otherwise, it would be impossible to make much resolution out of the lower portion of that.
Yeah, for sure. All right, yeah, and some of the more fine grained log scale ones, you could really see like the smooth curve, which is pretty cool. Okay, so you had a great idea for this segment. I wanted to do something on this that will tie together a lot of things that I wanted to talk about. Part of this show was explaining machine learning and probability and data science and how to look at the world through that lens, through the lens of mathematics. And so the new segment I want to announce today is we're going to do a probability distribution of the week, and we're going to learn about different types of probability distributions. Now, first of all, I don't think it's not obvious to people like what a probability distribution is. It's not just a bunch of curves on a graph, you know. So
I feel like it's something that you don't really talk about much until you get into you know, intro probability and statistics. And even there, right. It's kind of glossed over.
Right. You know, you have like box and whisker charts and things, and that's essentially, looking at a probability distribution. But the way I look at it is that, and you kind of have to understand what a mathematical space is, but a mathematical space we've talked about before is actually... I have a whole article on mathematical space, so let's say like how I defined it. But it's essentially a way of codifying different values that you're interested in. So I'd be interested to see. I'm going to look up how I a mathematical space is informally a collection of mathematical objects under consideration. The universe of mathematical objects within a space are precisely defined entities whose rules of interaction come baked into the rules of the space. A space differs from a set in several important ways, and then I go into that. So, okay, essentially, let's give some examples of a mathematical space. So, like, the most obvious one is just the real number system, the number line, or counting numbers is a mathematical space, or you could have, like, a Boolean mathematical space where there's only one and zero, or true and false. So it's just, it's basically the values under consideration. And so in probability theory, these are called events that can occur. A probability distribution is a way of assigning probability values to events, which is kind of like portions of this mathematical space, in a way that makes sense. So if the mathematical space is finite, like let's say there are only five things that we need to know. Okay, so we assign probability to all five of these events. They're all mutually exclusive. All those probabilities add up to one, and we kind of make sense. That's a probability distribution, but it's a finite probability distribution. It's a probability. They're probability masses.
Do that for something like rolls of a six-sided die.
Exactly. In continuous space, you can't do it as cleanly, because in continuous space, you know, really what you're talking about is a region of it. So let's say there's, I don't know, let's say I'm going to land on a, I'm going to throw a dart, right? And what's the probability that I land on the inner circle there? Well, there are lots of points within that inner circle.
Say an infinite number of points.
Sure. Maybe not, if not physically, then in our mathematical abstraction of it, there are. So essentially, you want to have like continuous blotches, and you want to be able to assign those probabilities in a way that makes sense. So that's all it is. It's an assignment of probabilities to different regions, which are called events, or different event space, different event sets, and it needs to be done in kind of a reasonable way. So there are rules. You can't just be like, okay, let's say the target has concentric circles, right? You can't just say, okay, I think the probability of being in the inner circle is 50%, but the probability of being in the second circle out is now 20%. Well, that doesn't make sense, because the outer circle contains the inner circle. So if the inner circle is 50%, the outer circle has to be at least 50% too. So there's some criteria that's given in mathematics. Kind of the traditional one is called the Kolmogorov criteria. This guy Kolmogorov, he did like everything, if you know that. But he comes up in AI too, at Kolmogorov complexity. But I think some of his criteria might be too strong, but there's some obvious things like, okay, if you have two mutually exclusive event spaces, then the probability should add, right? So some of the areas where I think it's okay to relax his criteria based on my personal experience in probability is, first of all, I think it's okay not to assign probabilities to certain parts of the space. Mathematicians often want to be complete. They want to be like, okay, we've assigned numbers to everything and you know, everything's all good. But I think in the real world, there are cases where we want to say, hey, there's a 90% chance the answer is in this region, and we'll assign very good probabilities in this region here. But on the 10% outside, we're not going to assign probabilities. We just don't know. I can assign some base probability distribution on that 10% outside, but, you know, there's some overhead in doing that. So I wouldn't necessarily require someone do that. I also, and this is again controversial, I don't think that they need to be normalizable. So in the case of the finite case, you want all the probabilities to add to one. That should always be possible, because you just divide by the sum. In the continuous case, if you know calculus, the area under the curve is supposed to be one. Sometimes that's not possible either, but I think there are cases where that should be okay. One of the obvious cases is pick a random, counting number. You know, every number has the same probability. So the number one has the same probability as the number 10, and has the same probability of, 10 to the 100th power. What's the probability of any given number? It's zero, because, they're all,
one over infinity.
Exactly. And so that wouldn't be allowed by certain criteria, but actually you can analyze that situation in a Bayesian sense. Now, probably in the real world, when you then go to model the real world, you don't want an unnormalizable distribution, but they're often very helpful in mathematics as like, okay, this is an extreme case that I want to see what the boundary is. So that's my take on that. For some people listening, this is probably going over their heads a little bit, but if the crypto stuff didn't. I think we're going to get into it case by case on a case by case basis. So I don't think we're going to go. I already mentioned a few probability distributions in the last in the last few minutes, but I think we're gonna start. I don't know what the first one to start at is. It might be the categorical distribution, which I already mentioned, which is the one where you just have a finite number of things. I think we could do a deep dive on that because sometimes it's a little more complicated than it seems at first glance. So, all right, this will be fun. And I think if we do this 5 to 10 times, we'll get a good understanding of the different types of probability distributions and we'll all be like a lot smarter. So,
how many distributions do I need to get on my distribution of the week punch card before I get a free distribution?
They're all free. yes, they're all free. They're all normalizable to infinity. So they're all free.
So if you're listening out there and you have a favorite distribution that you want to make sure that we talk about, let us know.
Right. Go on to localsmaximum.locals.com or just send me an email, localmaxradio@gmail.com. All right. I think that's it for today. I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else?
No, I'm looking forward to talking more about distributions in the future. And I'm looking forward with maybe a little more angst to seeing how this crypto stuff shakes out.
Yes. Well, if you thought you were afraid of the crypto stuff, be very afraid of the distributions because they're coming for you. So hopefully we'll do some. Hopefully come on the show and maybe come here because then we'll do it together. Because I assume I could do these on the solo show as well, but it's kind of more fun to do these together. Maybe we could like record a bunch of them and clip them in. So all right, great. It's really great to be back. It's great to be back home after traveling and Porkfest and North Carolina and all that stuff. And this comes out 4th of July. So
yeah, I was going to say happy Independence Day to our American
happy Independence
listeners
Day.
And happy Canada Day to our friends to the North.
Canada Day is on 4th of July? No,
that's not. I think it's July 1st.
What?
Don't quote me on it.
How is it so close to ours that that's unfair? All right. I'm sure they're more upset about it than we are. All right. Sounds good. Yeah, Canada's not too far from here. All right. We'll wrap up with that. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.